Case number 13-7002. Ian Philip James, Appellant versus International Painters and Allied Trades Industry Pension Plan et al. Mr. Burchell for the Appellant, Mr. Seprek for the Appellees.
Is it okay if I lower this a little bit?
Absolutely.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Kelly Burchell, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Ian Philip James. This matter really comes down to the appropriate standard that was set and utilized by the district court in a matter that involved the calculation of credits, specifically service credits for a pension plan. Now, my client, Mr. Ian Philip James, was a glazer for his entire career. From 1959 to 1972, he was part of the Glazers 963 Union, which had their own pension plan. Now, in 2005, when he retired, he submitted a claim for benefits. This claim for benefits
was a period of time that he became an owner.
Yeah, there was a period of time he did become an owner. Yes, that is true. But he did still have pension. He did still have service credits for the pension plan, which in 1998 actually merged with the International Painters and Allied Trust and Allied Trades Industry Pension Plan, which for simplicity's sake, I'm just going to refer to as IPAD. Now, what we have here is an application. The district court applied the deferential standard as articulated in Firestone by the Supreme Court. What we are saying was the application of this deferential standard was inappropriate under these circumstances because the de novo review should have been applied. Now, the Department of Labor has identified a very narrowed stream of facts wherein the de novo standard should be applied, even though the trust document itself grants the authority for deferential review and in those cases. Now, what we're saying is that any time that there is a breach of fiduciary duty.
Why are you referring to the Department of Labor?
Department of Labor is tasked with.
Are they a party? They're not a party.
They're not a party here, but their regulations that govern pension plans is.
I'm quite well aware of that.
Yeah.
What specific. Are you saying the Department of Labor regulations have been violated in this case?
Yes. And we cite two of the regulations that have been violated under the federal code in our brief, specifically the 29 CFR 2530.2001-3B, which mandates that pension plans have to be able to calculate service credits. There is a process that's outlined. Now, in the case of Mr. James, we're talking about service credits that were before 1973.
And before this pension plan was even in existence. This is no pension plan.
Well, that's the best way I can answer this question, that question, Your Honor, is basically there was a pension plan in place before 1979. And in this pension plan, it set up a method for calculating the calculating credits. And in that plan, it was a, it required 10 years of service credits in order to be vested. Now, the ERISA has stated that even though the plan existed before its enactment, they still had the trust still has the responsibility for calculating those credits. And they even laid it out in the CFR that I just cited. Now, when it comes to calculating credits before the enactment of ERISA, what the plan has to do is they have to take all documents that are reasonably available, and then they have to take the claimant's Social Security information and do reasonable estimates. Now, the problem is, and our position is, they breached their fiduciary duty.
Who?
The plan.
Which
IPAT.
One?
IPAT.
The existing.
The existing plan, which merged with the 963 plan.
They breached their fiduciary duty now?
They failed to keep reasonable access to these documents that are needed to make those calculations. And I know
that word reasonable is in itself a deferential standard.
Yes, it is.
What was unreasonable about what they did?
Well, for instance, Your Honor, that's a very good question. One, they didn't even have a copy of the trust plan itself, so they knew how to calculate those credits. It wasn't until my client provided the trust document that they even knew that there was a 10-year vesting. They actually thought that there was only 5 years for vested.
So what does that have to do with their breach of trust? I don't understand.
Well, how can a trust even know how to carry out their duties when they don't even have a copy of their own grants of power?
They calculated.
They calculated, but the problem was is that there's another information that they had to have reasonably accessible, and that is they had to know where the money came from, specifically which employers contributed to the trust.
Are you saying they had an obligation to have those records? I mean, the regulatory provision you are pointing to says the plan may use whatever records may be reasonably accessible to it.
Yes, and they
That's
didn't.
Different.
Yeah, and...
And this was a pre-ERISA time with respect to which this plan had no obligation to create any records. So it looks like this says when it comes their time, they have to look at whatever is there to be looked at. Now, did they fail to do that?
See, the problem is that even before ERISA, there were common law standards. Now, under these common law standards, they at least had to know where the money was coming from.
I understand, but what is it that's there for them to look at that they have failed to look at? I mean, I understand, it's great sympathy for you. There's a block of time that your client may well have worked as claimed under a collective bargaining agreement, but how do you find that out is the question. And there was no obligation on the part of the plan to create records during that period that they must now look at. So now who has to present what, and what have they failed to look at?
They have the obligation to at least know where the money came from.
Why?
Because if they don't know where the money came from, there's no way for them to determine.
This is a real nightmare situation. This is pre-them. Mm-hmm. It's pre-ERISA. It's during a... I'm totally sympathetic to what's being asked for here.
Yeah.
So we got to figure out who has what obligation. It's before they were around. They had no obligations to create anything during that time. None. Wait a minute. Let me tell you what my hypothesis is. You tell me if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't done anything other than merge, and the regulation you point to says they have to look at whatever is reasonably accessible to them.
And
now, what's reasonably accessible to them that they have not looked at?
Well, let me identify some of these facts and kind of lay it out the best way I can. Okay.
Now, could you ask, this is the one question I really need to have answered.
Yeah,
is reasonably accessible to them that they have refused to look at?
Well, first of all, when the initial denial came through, they said there was no record of my client whatsoever.
I understand all those sympathy points you get.
No,
I don't say that in a negative way.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But now we're down to a bare question.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that is reasonably accessible to them that they have failed to look at. I understand all the silliness along the way, all the mistakes, the miscalculations, all of that was ridiculous. But now we're down to a simple question. What's there that they have failed to look at?
Well, first of all, they failed to conduct a proper investigation with the union. Now, if you look through
the... What union?
The Glazers 963 in their database. First of all...
They never looked at any of the union records?
They denied, they made two initial denials, and then they started looking. And it wasn't until they conducted that investigation at that point that they found the document that did have Phil James's name on it with some of the numbers.
Right.
They made an immediate denial. They said, no, it's not here.
And then they conducted more investigation. What else is there that they haven't looked at? So they did eventually look at the union records.
Copies of collective bargaining agreements that the union has, as far as we can tell, they have not looked,
yeah, well,
looked at
that. What's that going to do with the price? Do you have any evidence that you put before the existing plan you call IPAN? Mm-hmm. Do you have any evidence that your client worked for the 10 years?
Yes, we do have his statements. That is in the record. We also have provided at least one other person who can testify, Mr. Swartz. His case was also brought in that could testify. Yes, he worked for he was a union member during this time period in question. That was brought into the case. And
did he ever testify?
Union member when he was an employer.
We're talking about 1959 to 1962. This was before...
That's the other fellow who ended up losing his benefits.
Yes, exactly.
After he said he would testify. Now, I'm not saying it was necessarily a connection, but it certainly was interesting. But in any event, did he ever come in?
He did not have the ability to testify. The reason why is because the court applied the deferential standard instead of giving him a chance to come forward and give testimony in court.
Do you have an affidavit?
I believe one is in the it's in the record. It's with the I believe it's the motion to intervene should be in the record, and I believe there's an affidavit in that. I apologize, I don't have the entire appendix right in front of me, but it would be towards the end. Where Schwartz did try to intervene in the case, and his intervention was
denied. But if there is a deferential standard, which is your argument against, why can we conclude it was unreasonable for the plan to say there's not sufficient evidence to show that your client worked the required 10 years? I think you're making an argument that goes to the merits rather than the deferential standard.
Yes.
And that's very circular.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from on that.
I thought your argument is that they have to follow reasonable procedures, and if they fail, and they don't get deference. There's nothing to defer to. So we're trying to figure out what is it procedurally that's what I understood your theory to be, that there are some circuits who have taken that view. You don't get high deference, even if the plan says that, if you've essentially abandoned all reasonable procedures. Mm-hmm. Now, this one fellow you're mentioning, I do recall him.
Yes.
I don't remember what you're talking about in terms of an affidavit. Was there a proffer to the court saying he will testify that I worked with him for an employer who was covered by a collective bargaining agreement and had the pension plan. Is that what the affidavit says?
I believe, I'm going through the entire appendix in my mind. I know he was listed he was disclosed as a witness. And I know during depositions he was identified as a witness in, I think I can give you the exact page where my client during a deposition identified Mr. According to my notes, it was about A583 through 584.
Is this the motion to intervene?
That was during a deposition. I know that my client, and I believe he was on the witness list during the lower proceedings as a witness that would testify in my client's favor.
But you had indicated that there was an affidavit.
I'm not 100% sure, but I do believe there was in the motion to intervene. I cannot remember off the top of my head.
Is there any evidence that he was a union member during the 59 to 62 period?
Yes, there is. There is evidence. I can't remember if it was entered in on the record.
We don't know whether that's in on the record. These are all critical facts.
Yes, I understand, Your Honor.
I mean, if you're riding on this procedural theory, they refuse to look at, they refuse to do due diligence, they look at the stuff that's relevant to the question, then we have to see that somewhere, or you have to say the district court wouldn't look at it. Does the employee who allegedly could have testified and wasn't allowed to, any information about his union membership, any information about the employer is being covered by a union contract? Those are the critical things. Then you've got a fighting chance. Well, where's the evidence?
I believe it is in the...
Did you try this below?
No, I did not.
Okay. Well, it should be familiar.
Yes.
And really, the question is not so much what the district judge did. The question is what did the plan do?
Right.
Was there evidence presented to the plan?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, there was evidence presented to the plan.
What
evidence is what we're trying to figure out?
Okay. What actually happened in the matter with Mr. Schwartz is actually being litigated over in the Maryland Federal District Court right now.
Well, we understand that possibility. That is, there was this person. We'll ask the plan attorney whether they refused to listen to what this guy had to say. That's one piece. Yeah. But the union membership, the collective bargaining agreements, et cetera, what's the evidence that was presented to the plan?
There is evidence that was presented as far as my client's union membership in the form of a union membership card that has been entered in.
That covered that period.
That covered the period.
How does it cover the period? Wouldn't be dated. He served as a union member before that period. So what is it about that card that shows he was a union member? And he could have even been a union member while he was not covered by the plan.
Well, actually, during that time period, we're talking about where, and according to IPAT, even agrees in the court, and the lower court recognized it, is that any jobs in that period of time in Washington, D.C., involving Glazers, that was a closed shop. So there was no way for you to actually work as a Glazer in Washington, D.C. without being part of the union.
This is not the period of time when he was an owner. That's not the stake?
This is not the period of time where he was an owner.
Well, he did put in Social Security records saying that he worked for union employers.
Yes.
I remember that.
Yeah.
So the question is, their response was, well, we don't know whether he was covered by
a collective bargaining agreement.
All right. So what information was, we know he was working for union employers. What information is there that was proffered to indicate that he was covered by collective bargaining agreement?
Well, actually during his deposition, and that was entered into the record, and I go back to the appendix A 583 through 584, where my client does say, he said General Glass, J.A. Jones, Tompkin Builders, or Chase Glass. He said all of those during that time period were union employers. And he even went as far as to say, I could identify a number of gentlemen who could come testify on my behalf if they're still alive. And one of them that is still alive.
Yeah, but the question is, what did he proffer to the plan?
That was during the deposition. That was deposition taken by counsel.
Well, that deposition after litigation, but there was first a proffer to the plan before the litigation, before the plan turned it down, right?
Well, originally...
So the question is whether the plan... First of all, we're looking at the plan's discretion at the time the claim was made, not what happens in subsequent litigation. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
So what was shown to the plan? You're going straight into the deposition.
Right? His Social Security records were given to the... were given to the plan for them to make that determination.
That's all? Just the Social Security records?
I believe that's all.
Saying that he worked for union employers, that's what was pertinent.
Yeah, and he...
And allegedly union shops, I don't know how that is shown, but my understanding is there were union shops and you were required to be... But membership isn't the matter, it's whether you're a covered employee.
Yeah, the... In order to be a covered employee, you have to be a member of the union. In order to even be an employee and work as a glazer during this time period, you had to be a member of the union.
Well, that, it all goes that hand, certainly hand was in hand. One of those closed shop areas, yes, yeah. Even though that might have been not have been the law, but in any case, that was the reality.
It was. And even, like I said earlier, in IPAT's own briefs, and the district court even recognized that local 963 had collective bargaining agreements with area employers, making it unlikely for an employee to work in any of these shops without union membership. I mean, they themselves know this information. They know that this was a closed shop. They even say, yes, it was a closed shop. It was a closed shop area. And now they pull back and they say, well, wait a minute. Even though it's a closed shop area and these are employers in Washington, D.C., well, now you've got to show us collective bargaining agreements. That makes little sense.
Why couldn't you find collective bargaining agreements? Why is that so difficult?
Well, first of all, I've represented thousands of union members, and very few of them have copies of their own collective bargaining agreements today. I mean,
wait a minute. Both Judge Edwards and I once practiced labor law. So collective bargaining agreements don't disappear any more than the other agreements do. That's not a problem. So if they exist, they would have been easy to find.
Well, one, there's no dispute that they did exist because they're
yeah, but you but, have to show that they covered your client.
My client, as far as having a collective bargaining agreement for each and every employer, and if you look at the Social Security records, and this is very important, this wasn't a case where they worked with one employer for a number of years. They would go from this employer, and then when there was no more work, then they'd go down to the union house, they'd go to this employer. They didn't have collective bargaining agreements for every single employer. I mean, the union primarily kept a copy of these things, which the pension plan had to make utilized and did their investigations through. Matter of fact, if you look at the record, that's the sole area where they did their investigation. There's nothing that indicates they even checked the collective bargaining agreements.
But your hypothesis, the collective bargaining agreements didn't even exist covering your client. They were sort of implicit?
No. They had to have been in writing, considering the way the federal laws were. Yes.
So why? I don't understand why they can't be retrieved. It's not that hard. They don't disappear.
Well, right now I cannot answer that question, unfortunately, because first of all, if the union doesn't have a copy of them, or can at least say, yeah, it could be a simple summary that the plan could have that just says, okay, this employer can make contributions. It could be a very simple summary, but they got to at least have that document reasonably available to them so that they know. That's my primary focus. That they actually need to be able to go and say, oh, we know where this information is. We know where we can access it. They need to know where the money's coming from, not just the fact that there is a bag of money there and they don't know where it arrived.
Does the court have any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kent Seprek for the International Painters Pension Fund. I'd like to start just thematically. I think this case presents two important features of the arbitrary and capricious and deferential standard of review. First is, what we're looking for in this is a consistency principle. The arbitrary and capricious standard recognizes that there may be multiple reasonable ways to approach a problem. What it demands is that the trustees do something reasonable and apply it consistently to all employees. The solution that the trustees adopted here was to rely on the remaining computerized records of the Local 963 plan. That is consistent. It is fair to, is the most fair to provide uniform treatment among all employees.
Why? If you have someone, you have a limited number of people back in an earlier period, same national union, I'm assuming, and the question is whether or not there were collective bargaining agreements. We know from the Social Security records that he worked, and we know he worked for unionized employers. We know that they were essentially, quote-unquote, closed shops, because that's the way it operated back then. And so the likelihood of his being covered is very, very high. And if I'm a reasonable plan administrator and I care anything about people who previously worked for me, I'll check the agreements, because the assumption is if his Social Security records indicate he was there, it is very likely he was covered by a plan.
I think the trustees looked at it differently for two reasons, Your Honor. First, the one noted by Judge Walton is his pattern of employment is hit or miss in the period 1959 to 1962.
How do you know that? How do you know that until you go look?
We looked at the Social Security records when he came in and asked.
All right.
I mean, we do apply the, they did apply the computerized record. When you appeal, yes, we go to the Social Security records to see if they corroborate or contradict the remaining plan records. What you get with him is a very episodic work history from 1959 to 1962.
From the Social Security records.
Right, from the Social Security records.
But with union employers.
But all those union employers need not have just glaziers, just painters. They can also have laborers. They can have lots of other people who are not covered by the collective bargaining.
Yeah, union membership.
In a different union.
Excuse me?
It could have membership in a different union.
In other words, your view is he could have been working in different jobs, not just painters.
Yeah. Right. His work history is consistent with somebody who was working as a laborer, picking up his skills. His work history is consistent with somebody who was taking jobs itinerantly, finally learning a skill, finally getting sufficient ability to act as a glazier.
Wait, when do you know he got past the apprentice point? Do you know that?
We know he was initiated in 1962 and then worked consistently as a glazier from that point forward. His work history changes substantially at that point. As concerns Mr. Schwartz, we did look into Mr. Schwartz's record. Mr. Schwartz testified that he was working with Mr. James, but his memory proves to be quite fallible, because when you go back to the Social Security records...
Saying he was not a journeyman until 62?
He was not initiated into the union until 1962, which would be consistent with then working as a glazier. Whether as an apprentice or a journeyman, he had acquired sufficient skills to work as a glazier. His prior history is hit or miss. It is not continuous. As Judge Walton points out, the past service clause here goes is based on being covered basically continuously before the plan.
So if the council says it was a closed shop from 59 to 62, so if he wasn't initiated into the union until 62, your suggestion is he wasn't working as a glazier from 59 to 62?
Yes.
I see.
And you're basing it on surmise, and he's saying to the contrary.
And that touches the second point of our arbitrary and capricious standard. We have no, and that standard is particularly important for a pension plan. We have no ability to go back 43 years anymore. The people who employed him are no longer available, perhaps in any way. The people who kept the records are no longer available. The records of his job are no longer available. This is a proactive statute. That's one of the reasons he has the burden of proof. There are many union members who keep their wage stubs. If he had kept wage stubs, it would be very easy to establish what capacity he was working in. We have nothing left from him. All we have is Social Security records of a very episodic employment with these employers. It's very important at this point that the other participants not be affected simply because somebody comes in 40 years after the fact and says, I did this, when you can no longer disprove it.
Did Judge Walton have the information regarding what you now said about apprentice, journeyman, et cetera?
Yes, he did, Your
Honor.
And
that's in his opinion?
He addressed that, not that in his opinion. He addressed the lack of continuity and the past service clause. He did that.
Yeah, but that's a very different point. I mean, you're making a point. I was kind of shocked that I did not recall that. It's a very telling kind of observation to say he had not reached journeyman status until 62, which is at the end of the disputed period. I don't remember Judge Walton ever mentioning
that. No, he mentioned the fact that his employment is episodic.
Yeah, but that doesn't tell me much.
Well, it tells us that the past service clause talks about extending only to times you were working continuously under a collective bargaining agreement. His work history was so episodic that it wouldn't have been continuous even if he was working as a clerk.
What does continuous mean?
It just says years worked under a collective bargaining agreement.
Well,
there's no standard.
But you can count years a number of different ways.
Agreed, Your Honor, and that's the reason for the arbitrary and capricious standard.
No, that's not helpful. That was a good attempt, but that doesn't do it. Counsel. If he was with union employers during that whole period, and it may be some in and out, he may be accumulating a whole lot of time. That if you define years as count the months, he's got what he needs. He doesn't need much.
Could be. I have no way of going back and finding out if those employers only employed Glazers.
You don't have a finding from Judge Walton on this journeyman point that you just made. You just asserted it. There's no record evidence.
Well, wait a minute. It's not just a journeyman. Is it just journeyman? You say he doesn't become a union member until 62.
Is that in the record? Is what I'm asking.
Yes, he doesn't become a union member until 1962.
But he can still work in these union shops and be covered by a pension plan. He could have, right?
If we assume that those employers only employed painters. No laborers, no carpenters.
No, that's your point. Your point is he could have been doing other things.
He could have been. His work history is most consistent with being a laborer who finally picked up glazing skills and got admitted to the union.
Why do you say his work history is consistent with being a laborer back in 59 and 62? Why do you say that?
Because he jumps from job to job, he jumps from industry to industry. The point is that Judge Walton.
You're saying a good union member wouldn't do that.
I'm saying he was a young man learning, particularly adept. He had not been trained in one particular skill at that point. And Judge Walton accepts the finding of the trustees as not unreasonable in that respect.
Well, I mean, the reason you're getting peppered by me is talk about an unimpressive record of effort. These trustees rank very high in my imagination. That's as sloppy a mess as I've ever seen by a plan and trying to figure out what they're doing. They can't count. They can't find anything. I mean, it's really kind of outrageous, even giving you the benefit of it's hard to get records. What they did is a mess. And it really doesn't come across well at all.
I agree, Your Honor. The one point I can try and make there is one of the reasons we did these mergers is because we couldn't fix the past. We could have two choices. We could let the mess keep running.
Wait a minute. Do you concede that your present plan is operating as a mess, or were you suggesting the prior?
In this case, they were.
Yeah, see, that's what Judge Edward is.
In this case, it was a mess.
I agree, Your Honor, and it was caused by an initial swap of Mr. Schwartz's.
And that's part of what his argument is. You can't survive under the appropriate standard review if you show us a procedural mess. Now, I understand your argument is okay, but what do we do when we go back? I hear you, but it was a mess, and it certainly doesn't look like you would survive arbitrary and capricious in normal circumstances, because what we'd normally do with an agency under an arbitrary and capricious circumstance, oh, no, this is absurd. We're sending it back. Go do it right. I've never seen anything like this. This was really outrageous.
My time has expired. If I may, I'd like to respond to the question. You are correct, Your Honor, that the critical question then is, what do we get from going to a de novo standard?
Edwards is making a different point.
No.
He's saying, let's assume you have a deferential standard of arbitrary and capricious. Why didn't you fail that?
That's exactly what I'm asking.
See, I'm able to read his mind.
We've been together too many years.
What they did at the merger was ask the plan to create a list of vested participants. Mr. James did not appear on that list. So at the merger, we asked them to compile all their records up to date. We rely on that list. That's in the merger agreement. Mr. James comes in and says it's wrong. The plan has a standard practice. We'll then go back to Social Security records and see if there's an error. They get his Social Security records. They also dig deeper into what they got from the plan. They find the computer printout that has Mr. James, even though he's not vested. They can get his service record from 963. When they compare it to the Social Security records and the union records of initiation, they match what the local 963 plan has. The only issue is past service. They don't find any compelling evidence at this point to change what was in the plan records. And they have no ability to go back in the event of trial. They can't question the employers. They can't question the record keepers. So they have one hand tied behind their backs. In that circumstance, what they did is reasonable. Yes, it took many fits and starts. We have many, many problems with a lot of merged plans. All of our case law is deferred vested participants in these plans. But I can't go back and undo and make everything right. And part of it is, yes, Your Honor, in this case even, it's messed up at the plan because we have people who aren't familiar with that plan trying to read through its records, and they misread them. That's why we have an appeals process. If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to address them.
So, in other words, we should make a judgment based on what happened when it went up through the appeals process, and you've got a final look at everything.
Correct, Your Honor.
Would you concede it's messed up at that point? Or do you think you did a reasonable job of it?
I think we've looked at everything that exists and made a reasonable decision based on what remains.
In the end, it was a mess, though.
It is a mess, Your Honor, because we don't have any original records.
When you're saying a mess, are you conceding that you did a lousy, negligent job?
Difficult to follow.
If you were on the other side of this case, you would have such fun arguing. You would say this is absurd. I can hear you now. You would say there's no way. We shouldn't even be here talking. Send it back. Make them do it right. You know the argument, right? You knew you were going to get these questions, right?
Yes, but there's nothing more I can do. I cannot recreate things that no longer exist. We looked at everything that still exists. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll give you 1 minute.
I just want to touch up on a couple things that was discussed in opposing counsel's argument. And one of the big things was the whole issue that actually goes right to the core of my brief, and that is the time period from 1959 to 1962. I mean, we're not looking for anything before 1962. 1979 through 1980, we can't even discuss that.
I thought you were fighting about 59 to 62.
Yeah, we are. That's what
you said. We're not.
No, I said we're. I'm sorry, 1979 to 1980. I apologize, I misspoke. That we cannot discuss until we resolve this whole issue of 1969 through 1959. I apologize, I'm trying to speak quickly. 1959 to 1962. Those issues and those documents, those records, clearly have not been preserved. There's no ability for them to make even a reasonable judgment.
Well, wait a minute. If the documents don't exist.
Yes, that's your problem.
Isn't that your problem?
As far as the summary from 1973, but if they're...
Counsel, why are you going to 73? We're talking about...
Just stick with 59 to 62.
I was speaking towards the...
If the records do not exist, isn't that your problem? That's your burden.
No. We are submitting that in this case, it should be their burden to at least have something so that they can make reasonable calculations.
Documents don't exist. Let's assume they don't exist. How can you ask them to make a reasonable calculation?
Because we've provided information, both Social Security records and the statements from my client, as well as statements from at least one other person showing that he worked in that area.
What about this continuous service provision? Was that in the plan?
The continuous service provision was never actually interpreted by the court below.
Was it in the plan?
There,
off the top of my head, it was a certain amount of hours that was required, and it didn't. And it didn't say it. The continuous service dealt with a, I believe it was a full break, a full 1 year break in the time between working, if my memory serves me correctly. When it comes to the calculation of the service credits, it was a one full year break. Now, if he went from an employer to an employer to an employer,
what about the point that it's not established whether your client, 59 and 62, was actually working as a glacier?
Oh, we refute that point.
How?
That, well, first of all, we
offer... Because the companies did hire people other than glaciers, right? What is it that rebuts the assumption that he was a laborer?
He asserted that he went through the original training.
I know, but he has to have records. Everybody could assert this. And going back 40, 50 years, it was an obvious self-interest, and plans can't just rely on an assertion, can they?
Plans can't, yeah, I understand that. However, we have provided other witnesses, identification of other witnesses, that he did work as a glacier, that he did go through the training process, and that he came out of that training process in 1959. And that was provided to the plan.
As written, but not from records.
Not from records.
Right. Can I ask the union attorney, the plan attorney, one question?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have another question for you, if you don't mind.
I'm sorry, I forgot. What about the alleged witness?
Mr. Schwartz was the only witness.
Yes, the person who would have allegedly said, I worked with him during this period, and he was in a covered arrangement.
Yes, Mr. Schwartz's, and that was one question I meant to answer for the court. Mr. Schwartz's Social Security records were also pulled. Turns out he and Mr. James only worked one quarter, Social Security quarter together. I believe it was January 1960 of the three-year period at issue. So we did not attach great weight to Mr. Schwartz's statement that they had worked continuously for 3 years.
Where does continuously come from? The word continuously?
It just says work under a collective bargaining agreement before the plan was established.
So you have assumed that means continuous?
It meant something more than episodic.
No, but that isn't the point. How much more time does he need, a half a year?
It wasn't counted by hours for past service
or
before.
No, he's short about half a year, right?
No, it's 3 years. Right?
He would need...
they have 9.5, is that
he would
correct?
Need 0.8 years.
0.8. So that's what I mean. He may have easily had those many hours in a covered employer during 59 and 62.
But past service was only counted in full years. Only future service was counted in partial years.
Full years, meaning it doesn't matter whether it's episodic as long as we reach a year.
It's the plan counted it pragmatically as being evidenced by union membership before you joined the plan.
Now, explain to me what I was confused. What is this full year versus future years?
Past service is before the plan was established.
Right.
Yeah.
And Judge Walton goes into great detail, finds that the plan only credits full years.
You're talking about the old plan, not the new plan.
The old plan, yes,
right.
Before 1962.
So before 1962, full years.
Full years.
But that still doesn't tell me what you mean. Full years meaning I worked 3 months, then I stopped, then I worked another 6 months, that's nine, and then I stopped, and then I worked another three again, so that's a year.
We have no contemporaneous interpretation of that clause.
That's the whole point.
The plan did apply full and partial years for past credit. They based it on evidence of union membership. That's allowed by a District of Maryland decision many years ago.
So the key here was union membership. If you had had evidence that he was a union member from 59 to 62, you would have treated the case differently?
Or if he had pay stubs with wages?
No, just answer that question.
Yes and no.
Yes and no? What do you mean?
Yes, generally. That's how they ran it in their computer. If the plan got evidence of wage stubs, we have cases where employers didn't pay contributions.
Oh, no, but a union membership would have been sufficient to do it.
It would have been sufficient.
Yes.
Yes, that's why I said that the answer is yes. You don't have that. You could have gone with other evidence, too, which you didn't have, arguably, either. But you would have done it with union membership from 59 to 62. You didn't have evidence of that.
Yes, because the union membership would also show monthly dues payments and work.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you. So